nation building and too much something else? Or?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. In my own small world, the Chuhoy program, the nation building kinds of things that we should have been doing, and you know, that wasn't the emphasis. The emphasis was on the drops and the leaflet drops and on the trying to get intelligence, which was valid. That was one of the reasons for the program. But to really see it, to really see it be successful, and you needed the people to know that something good happened to these people that came in. And then the word got out. No problem getting the word out to the people that were working for the other side. If you got the, you know, if good things did happen, but we weren't completing the circle, so to speak, in my program. And then the community development types of things, the nation building things, were just de-emphasized, it seemed to me. This CORDS thing was a bureaucratic nightmare. CORDS in itself was enough to chase me away to Laos, I think. I never seen anything so crazy in my life. Military trying to get, you know, me, I work for Lieutenant Colonel, and then I have a major working for me. Holy smoly. I wrote this guy was not exactly an exemplary figure. I feel I wrote his evaluation up as, you know, in a fairly honest way, and then I learned very quickly that in the military, if you don't have 99.9%, your career is in jeopardy. So I was, you know, I got that kind of rude awakening, and all that kind of stuff just turned me sour. It just didn't seem like we were going and working against ourselves instead of working to a common end.
When you said if more aggressively, mm-hmm. what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean more aggressive, being more aggressive in terms of, for instance, the vocational training program. You know, we had bricklayers classes and we had carpenters classes. We could have had auto mechanics could have been, but we couldn't get the funding for it. And that's an example. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the job placement, we could have organized a way to really get these people plugged into back into the society, mm-hmm. and got them jobs and work with the leaders of in communities and urban communities to do that. And we didn't have the funds to do that either.
Since this is on someone else's tape, could you describe what Frank Manley did in Laos and what you were doing for Frank?
Yeah, Frank was a distributor we call them manufacturer's reps, but he was a manufacturer's rep for many different things. He had Kodak and International Harvester. He actually, I think his main money maker was representing TWA, writing the tickets for all the AID and American government personnel that were traveling back and forth to the United States. He was a ticket agent, essentially. But he had his hands in a lot of different stuff. I had come on to be his business manager because of my business background. He was another guy that was sort of disorganized from the standpoint of his financial comings and goings, and trying to integrate and bring build systems to help him integrate everything. So that's what I intended to do for him.
But your father became ill, and you went back to the States. And what did you do in the years after that? We'll come back to
sure.
a couple of Southeast Asia questions, but
sure.
just briefly, what did you do and what are you doing now?
Okay. After Laos, or that last experience in Laos, I went back to the United States. I lived for a short time with my dad in this Charlotte and in Naples, Florida, where he retired. And then I took a job with a manufacturer in Jamestown, New York, my birthplace. Got the job through some relatives. They were looking for somebody with the kind of background I had. I actually worked as the assistant to the president of a division, and then became an assistant to the president of the corporation. And I did acquisition merger kind of groundwork, kind of going around trying to get look, do the first look, the first triage of merger acquisition candidates. Mm-hmm. Then I got married in 1970 and moved to California. I worked for a short time in the brokerage, actually a brokerage company sent me back, it sent me to California. It was the only kind of, it was the aerospace crunch in California. It was hard to get a job. I knew I wanted to live in California. Both my wife and I wanted to live in California. And nobody was hiring, so except brokerage firms who were discounting the future like they always do. So I hooked on with one of them, and I hated that work and very quickly left it and went to work for a guy who's famous in Laos. Bill Bird ran Bird & Sons, which was a provider of helicopter and fixed-wing services to AID. He had a construction company in Thailand. He had a hotel in Oakland, mm-hmm. and he had property in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And he was in need of a financial guy. And I had the hotel experience, I had the Asian experience, mm-hmm. and I had the... fit really well with him.
How did you find out that he had a job going?
It was the funniest thing. I was selling stock for the stock brokerage thing, and I called on him. He had an office in San Francisco. I said, geez, I know this guy. I've seen this guy before. And I couldn't. He sees me, and he sees me before. It was just one of those things. That he said, and he never. It wasn't like that, I'm going to offer you a job. It was like 3 months later. Uh-huh. He took my card and needed a controller, so he hired me as his controller. Mm-hmm. And I ended up working for him for a number of years as his controller. I went to Laos a number of times and doing audits and things like that, and ultimately became the manager of the air division for a year because the guy that was the manager left the company in Laos just as we lost our helicopter contract in Laos, and we had four helicopters that were idle. Mm-hmm. And I back here sold a contract to Morrison Knutson in Zaire. Mm-hmm. And we transported the helicopters to Zaire, and I ran that contract for a year in Zaire.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked for him until I think it was 75, I think. I became familiar with the major U.S. construction companies when I was working in Vietnam. I was around Cam Ranh Bay and Nha Trang and so forth, and I got to know some guys. So I knew the way that business worked. So I had some contacts, and I moved into Bechtel, the big engineering construction company. I worked for Bechtel for about two tours with Bechtel. One up until 1980. Then I took a break and did an entrepreneurial thing, and then I was hired back by Bechtel. And I worked for Bechtel in a number of different places, Indonesia.
Did you take your family with you, or just
tried to? Uh-huh. Tried to one time, but because of an ear infection complication of my older son, we were going to Sulawesi, which is and. Man, it's rough out there, and there was no, it would take a day and a half to get to Singapore if he had a burst eardrum or something like that, and Bechtel finally said he couldn't go. And I already had my visa to go, and they came to me and said, look, it takes so long to get a visa, would you take a single status assignment for a short time? And I said, yeah, I would. So I went for 6 months, single status. I worked for him there, and then I came back, and I became the. I worked in Toronto for a while. There was this particular project was Worldwide Project, and Toronto had a piece of it. I worked there for a while. Then I joined. I actually became the assistant to the controller of Bechtel, the big assistant to the controller of operations, and then he became the controller, and I became his assistant there too. Mm-hmm. And I did all kinds of running around for him. I went to Zambia and spent time in Zambia, working with the central bank there, working with him. What that really means
is
I was sitting on a doorstep trying to get paid, is what it really was. I spent a good 6 or 8 years with Bechtel, and then I moved to a nuclear engineering company in South San Jose for a short period of time when they were going after international nuclear business. Uh-huh. And when they hired me, and about 2 months later, they decided they wanted to get out of the international business because of backlog and cash flow problems. Uh-huh. So that didn't work out for me. I stayed with them still for, maybe a year. But then a couple of guys from, actually four guys from Bechtel, who had worked with me in the mining and metals division very early on, started their own consulting company and asked me to come with them. And so for about from 84 until 91, I was working with them and doing different kinds of... I'm gonna turn it off.
So you worked until 91 with these former Bechtel.
These former Bechtel guys, and in the course of that, most of the work that I did was in, that's interesting, sort of an interesting deal from a business perspective. These guys were mining guys. Mm-hmm. I'm not a mining guy, but I was a Bechtel guy. And we found that there was a large similarity between the mining industry of maybe 10 years before from an accounting standpoint and the healthcare industry. Mm-hmm. Because of the change that Reagan brought about, the DR, what's called DRG, diagnosed related groups, mm-hmm. which effectively changed the playing field from a cost plus type of an arrangement mm-hmm. to a fixed price kind of an arrangement.
Right.
And then all of a sudden healthcare institutions needed to know what their costs were. Mm-hmm. Before it was just add a percentage on and mm-hmm. didn't care what their costs were. So we found a little niche in that and started a division, a healthcare division. And because of that, and also the other thing I did in those days was I was very much in tune with and working in Zambia mm-hmm. and Great Britain because of the close contact between those, and doing strategic planning and general consulting in the cargo handling and different kinds of things. So we had a regular consulting business. We were tied to the World Bank. We got jobs through the World Bank and Stanford Research and so forth, mm-hmm. and had a good run, but about 1991, I had one kid that I'd sort of been around a lot, but not enough, I thought, who was going off to college, and another son, the one you saw come down the stairs, was just getting into high school, and most of the work had, now it was in healthcare, but it was healthcare in Zambia, mm-hmm. and I was going to have to go live there, it looked like, spend an awful lot of time. Most of my travel there had been 6 weeks over there, mm-hmm. and then back for two, and 2 weeks over and back for six, that kind of stuff. Never really, I mean, I still maintain my residence here. Mm-hmm. But then it was going to be a full-time deal, so I decided to look around, and I hooked up with Kaiser Permanente. You know who they are?
I was a Kaiser kid.
Oh, you were, okay.
Raised all my kids.
Well, I've been with Kaiser now probably a little bit more than 5 years.
Hmm.
And I went with them in a data quality improvement project. And now I'm working for them in research and development. I'm actually called the technical coordinator of the innovation program. Innovation program is a program that provides skunkworks capital to docs and nurses and whomever has an idea that they can't really aggressively pursue in the course of their normal workday, but want to pursue in any event. So
rural development.
Yeah.
Community development.
Yeah, community development. Uh-huh. There's a lot of similarity. In fact, I use the metaphors often uh-huh. to try to explain how we can get these projects done. You know, that community development metaphor. Uh-huh. So that's what I'm doing now.
Well, that's great. And speaking of which, how did you feel when the war ended in 75?
For me, it was hard to. I wasn't around the media.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Indonesia and mm-hmm. Sulawesi,
mm-hmm.
and almost didn't know about it until after. You know, so it was a very strange ending to the war for me because mm-hmm. of the remote location that I was in. We didn't have access to daily news, well, we have the shortwave stuff, but mm-hmm. And I felt, I hate to lose. I hate to lose anything, and I felt like I felt badly, not, you know, from a personal perspective, because I was on a losing team.
Mm-hmm.
I had that. I know. I remember having that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I felt that the right side had won. I guess to be honest with you, I wasn't admitting right away that we lost either.
Mm-hmm.
I said it's a draw. People say it's a loss, but it's a draw.
Mm-hmm.
And I, for a long time, went along with that. But I still didn't even like the idea of a draw. So.
Mm-hmm.
So those were the visceral feelings that I felt.
That was a draw because communism was contained in Vietnam. And
yeah, my theory about not getting past Thailand, it was true.
Right, okay.
So here,
right. So the Cambodia thing, well, just that's a... We'll
the
just
Cambodian
that.
Thing was
yeah.
the most the most amazing thing to mm-hmm. me, because I always saw this difference in Buddhism as being a marker. You know, the Theravada Buddhists and the Mahayana
oh, yeah.
Buddhists.
Okay.
And the Thai, the Lao, the Cambodians being Mahayana Buddhists all seemed to be the same, easy mannered, you know, couldn't kill an ant, if, you know, and the Vietnamese being kind of a vicious, that was a perspective of going to Laos first,
right,
I think.
Right.
You know, you're,
yeah.
you, and you come, and these people are, man, they just as soon cut your throat as not, and so forth. And that was part of the sinicization of Vietnam, mm-hmm. and it was different. It was like the Annam Mountains mm-hmm. had just sort of dissected these two things. And I sort of felt that that made a big difference. That and getting back to what I was driving at, mm-hmm. the Cambodians, I couldn't believe what happened in Cambodia, because it was so uncharacteristic of the people. I knew, because Pak Sae was so close to Cambodia, and I worked in Kon Island, which is right on the border, that I so I knew some Cambodians. I just, the nature of the people just didn't seem like it, that could possibly happen, that Holocaust essentially could possibly happen. I still to this day think that's the most incredulous thing about my experience. I mean, I wasn't there at the time, but when I look at the effect of the experience over there, the Cambodian thing just is unbelievable, truly unbelievable. And I know I hear that, I mean, one of the explanations is that these people were taken back to China and trained, and their whole mindset was, and they were able, they were charismatic, and they got a following, and it sort of was like a snowball going downhill. That still doesn't, in my mind, explain it, because I can't see that happening in Laos, for instance, and I sort of equated the Thai and the Lao, I mean the Cambodians and the Lao, because of the Theravada.
Well, the Path of Lao, apparently after 75, the Path of Lao had their own ideological and idiosyncrasies that they tried to impose. But that just happens when you're
up north.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. But the Khmer Rouge, you know, the thing is, there might have been something that. Well, first of all, you're not alone. Nobody understands that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, everyone was surprised by it. Let's put it that way. But the other thing is, I think that there was probably an undercurrent of Cambodian xenophobia that just never surfaced to the, you know, the Western folks weren't as plugged into it as much as it was, and these people tapped into that, and their techniques were astounding.
Yeah.
And
imagine that's worth a study, and it's probably been studied.
Oh, and it's will continue. There were like three new books out on it as it is, but The Shining Path and The Khmer Rouge just have tremendous psychological warfare operations systems built in with what they're doing, because it's akin to their ideology. It's not artificial. You know, that's the problem with psychops, that kind of thing.
I want to just say something here. One of the things you asked me before, the question about being aggressive, that's the other thing I thought that we... It became a market economy for me.
Mm-hmm.
If these guys are going to have these tools and the reindoctrination piece they were so good at it. We knew they were so good at it. Mm-hmm. Why can't we do it as well? Why can't we learn from them? Why don't we borrow from them? What if that's what it is about? It was both that piece plus the other end of it, the vocational training and mm-hmm. the job placement thing. But we were always getting criticized and said that, you know, that piece of our stuff, it was just horrible. It was, Mark, it was sitting up in a daytime in a classroom environment and having some horrible instructor instruct you on, you know, South Vietnamese government or something like, you know, versus what you have in your mind about these guys sitting around a campfire at night having this stuff drilled into them night after night after night after night. I said, come on, we've got to do something that's better than they do if we're gonna win.
It's also bringing 16-year-old girls from the NLF to say, aren't you willing to fight for your country with us?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. I mean, sure, but yes. Whatever it takes, I guess.
Yes.
I didn't know, that wasn't my end of it, and I didn't want to be involved in that end of it. But that was, and this was a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
This program was a continuum, and this front end stuff wasn't getting done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I meant about being, if you're going to be there, you need to be aggressive.
Yeah.
I was more concerned with my own self, with the back end of it.
So you were very surprised about what happened in Cambodia. You were in deep denial about what had gone on in Vietnam a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And did those views change over time? I mean, you said the right guys had won. That's a truth. Gee whiz, don't they hang ex-USA people for saying that? No, I'm kidding.
Maybe.
But, yeah. Most IVSers.
Well, the people deserving of, the people that really were committed to winning war won the war.
Mm-hmm.
The people that was my belief. It's like a team, a basketball team that trains hard, practices hard, has good discipline and so forth versus a bunch of clowns. You know, I that's another metaphor, a bunch of clowns.
Mm-hmm.
It pretty much says it.
Mm-hmm. What was your take on that, about that lack of cohesion and will in the Republic of Vietnam?
Well, I think it was the core problem.
Mm-hmm. But what did you feel about its origins or its nature? I mean, they're the same folk, or similar anyway,
mm-hmm.
to the people who are doing all the really effective things.
Well, I thought the environment, the of wealth, money, the money, was the, you know, the fact that we would continue to support these horrible habits of these people was the paramount problem. In later times, in doing reading and trying to figure things out, I always felt that we should have looked back at the times that we won these sorts of things. We, being the Western world, won these things like in Malaya and in the Philippines, and you know, what was it about those experiences that there were corrupt officials in those circumstances as well? What did we do about those things? But I never saw, the only guy I thought had a chance was Min, and he obviously wasn't acceptable to enough people, and he was certainly acceptable to our people while I was there. I mean, he seemed to be the one that everybody gravitated toward, but he wasn't acceptable to their people, and that was, of course, the crux of the...
Did you ever have a read on General Khan? He was, of course, gone from Vietnam. I think they made him ambassador somewhere.
Yeah, no, I never
but
did.
But there was a time early on that he said something like, you know, we're being invaded by two countries.
Do you remember Marshal Surratt?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
He is, in my mind, the model of the person that was needed, that kind of individual. Corrupt, yes, what I consider to be a benevolent dictator. That was the most effective Asian leader that I ever saw. And I'm not telling. And I talked to the Thai about him,
mm-hmm.
and I said, "What is it about this guy? I mean, he's corrupt. He's no different. What makes him different?" He said, "Well, it was balance. He was corrupt, but he didn't. He gave back as well as stole. He wanted to move the country ahead. He really did want that. It was in the Buddhist way of seeing things. You know, he he was he had been reincarnated in a higher form, and he deserved the spoils of corruption. But he was smart enough to understand, in order to get to the next level, he had to give back to the people just enough. And in that, he was the epitome of my what I thought they needed, and I didn't see anybody in Vietnam that even came close to that guy. And I'm not sure that's the view of a naive 20-year-old, 25-year-old. Mm-hmm. He may have, in essence, killed zillions of people that I don't know about. But I lived in Thailand at that time, and he was in power. And he definitely was what I thought. I didn't think democracy was right for Thailand, for instance. I just didn't think it would work in our form of democracy. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the country needed that level of dictatorship. If it was going to be, if it truly was benevolent like it was, it seemed to me to be.
Have you ever had anything, we're coming to the end here.
As long as you want.
I
think my wife's coming with some food here, hopefully, so we might be able to get a sandwich or two.
Do you get the IBS newsletter?
Mm-hmm.
Things like that? Are you a member of the Alumni Association?
I don't know. I get all their stuff, and I pay them from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I got the recent one I got, which is an interest. It's a change. They're mm-hmm. trying to get more aggressive. It seems a little bit more business-like. I think I'm talking about websites and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and or at least internet access to each other and things like that. So that's. I think that's a step in the right direction. I applaud that.
What do you think about the fact that, you know, they've shifted away from sending Americans overseas and are essentially working with third country nationals and nationals within the country they're serving, who might already be doing that work, but now
mm-hmm.
they're doing that work with support from IBS?
That's maybe not exactly the perspective that other people have, but I think we did an awful lot with locals when we were, you know, what we call locals when we were there. I think the only difference is, you know, the American presence isn't there. You've sort of taken out a middleman in a sense. The people, an awful lot of the work that was done by what we would call assistants, or they weren't really counterparts, but they were guys that were, I'm like the guy I trained in the
business
office thing. And I had a guy that worked with me in the on the co-op thing as well. You know, so what you've taken away is the American. I'm sure it's a budgetary type of a situation.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be nice to sprinkle a few U.S. folks over there as well. I don't know exactly what the structure is at the top. I mean, maybe it's run out of, obviously Don is is the CEO.
Well, was.
Oh, is he not anymore?
Yeah, there's been a kind of palace coup.
Wow.
And Don is going to still be with IBS. He's going to handle the AIDS program. But,
in Thailand?
In Southeast Asia, generally. He's going to raise money for that and stuff like that. But Don needed to move to Buffalo. And there was apparently... I think he wanted people in the office behind him who he trusted and was confident in. And there were other people in there that he didn't have that confidence in. He wanted to replace them, and the board essentially sided with the others, saying that, well, no, we have confidence in those people, that kind of thing.
Are you on the board?
No, I don't have any connection with that, yes. But this just happened. This happened like last week.
I see.
And I've interviewed a couple of people who are on the board. And that summation might be completely inaccurate, because I'm getting, you know, fragmented over the phone and
right.
I don't really know what's going on. But I think apparently Don will not be the executive director. Although what Don wanted to be was an executive director in absentia, and there would be someone else in the office in Washington who would do most of the work. And I think the issue really was, well, Don, either you're here doing this or not, in this kind of ideal situation
mm-hmm.
where isn't going to work out. The ideal thing of
right.
of that isn't going to work out. And maybe
for family
happen.
Reasons or something, you
yeah,
need to go to
no,
Buffalo?
Yeah.
You can't run the thing out, not in Washington. I think you need to be
yeah,
the
but in any event, Don, you know, as I was talking, I think it was June or summer, and The thing about Don is Don represents a continuity of IBS. And it's fairly important on an organization that's essentially an NGO.
Right.
That it has a sense of what it is.
Did you have Ziegler and Walt Coward on your list of people?
They're not. They don't live on the West Coast.
I see.
And
are they in the other fellows?
He might be, but we've got these huge piles of forms, and I've got the ones over here. And but I think I think we could meet Bob and Gene Stolfus and Don Whitfield. He lives in Chicago.
You're not making any distinction between the education piece and
absolutely. We're just taking the people who send in forms and live in a place where we can get to them without, they're like one person
study,
in Idaho.
It's interesting study criteria.
Oh, absolutely. And I wonder about that because, we need to bring this to a close. But
since we're on AOL,
if I have any other questions, since you're online,
sure.
I can just email you for anything else. Well, thank you very much. This is a wonderful conversation, let alone oral history. But anyway.